Afternoon. Gosh, now that everyone's in the room, it actually feels more spacious. Isn't that interesting? Or it does to me, anyways. We had a question of what is Dharma and how does it relate, or let's see, how is it tied to a Dharma talk? So first I should say that Dhamma is the Pali word and Dharma is the Sanskrit word. And Buddhism, of course, was a oral tradition, and then one of the first recorded language is called Pali, so Dhamma is in that, and that's mostly considered the Theravadan tradition of Buddhism. And then later, historically, the Mahayanists, so then the language of that is with Sanskrit, so it's Dharma, but they're the same word. So the Buddha, is a real human being who is from India, maybe near the Pakistan border, and he achieved enlightenment. And then his teachings are called Dharma. One of the roots of Dharma is Dharati, or Dharati, which means nature. So the Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha, and it's also the laws of nature as defined by Buddhism. So Buddha, Dharma, and then the Sangha are what's called the three treasures of Buddhism. Sangha is the community of practitioner. Originally, it was the monastics, or the people who follow the Buddha. There's a lot of different ways of also understanding all that. Like, Buddha is often thought of as the example that we all have the capacity for awakening. Dharma as the how to do that, or how to know that, and the Sangha is how to enact that, or how to make that happen in interaction. I will say sometimes you read Dharma with a small d, and that means phenomena. Small Dharma is anything that's a phenomenon. There is some Pali canon that will name, I don't know, 84,000 small dharmas or something like that. So the Dharma is the teaching, and they come in different groups. Like the four Brahma Viharas are one group of Dharma teachings, and the Four Noble Truths is another. Depending on which sect of Buddhism, and historically, there are different ways of interpreting, since one, it was oral, and then I think the first, I'm really bad at history. I think like 4 years after the Buddha died, they first did the first recording, which according to Thich Nhat Hanh, I think it's a different language, starts with an A, I can't remember how to pronounce it, it's not Pali. And then maybe, I don't know how many years after it was the Pali. So, that's, and it was recited by his attendant, Ananda. And that's why many sutta is a Pali word, sutra is the Sanskrit word. You hear, thus I have heard. It's because Ananda is retelling. He was supposed to have perfect memory, right? And recitation. So, all right. So, and in all sects of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths are agreed upon. That one, nobody questions. And so it's the central teaching of Buddhism. So we've been talking about the Four Noble Truths, and today we are on the Third Noble Truth. So remember the first, simply, the condensed version is that in life there is suffering. The second is that there's the origin for the causes and conditions for suffering to happen. And the third is that the cessation of suffering is possible. And the fourth is that the Eightfold Path is the development for the cessation. So, and as we've been talking about how pairing it with the four Brahma Viharas as qualities of mental states that support working with each of these noble truths. So mudita is the third one. So if the cessation of suffering is a third noble truth, then joy would be a really good response. So that's partly how this came to be. Now, mudita is translated in several ways as sympathetic joy, empathetic joy, altruistic joy. So maybe we should also talk about the Brahma Viharas as really practices of cultivation and of aspiration. I think I did speak of that. And also, I think the key is to remember that they're practices. You know, sometimes people come and they say, well, it's really hard. That sounds great, but how do I connect to that? And in fact, that is the purpose, is in practicing, we know more. In fact, Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, the lineage of Min from Japan, says that practice and realization are not separate. In the doing, you realize. For instance, you know, you could read a lot about how to ride a bicycle, but until you're on a bicycle, then you realize bicycle riding, right? Okay, so, and sometimes we forget that because sometimes we read things and we're given information in the teaching. And so we think, oh, the more information I get, and then we get stuck in, you know, saying, well, that means that, and that means that. And of course, like any set of wisdom teaching that has lasted almost 2,600 years, there's been a lot of fights about what does what mean exactly, right? So this is why, on a certain level, maybe people got confused when I said, you know, in Zen, when I say I open my mouth, everything I say is wrong. On one level, it's because to give words to it on a certain level limits, because it only is my experience of it that I'm sharing. There is no, while there's a set of truth in the sense of just like love. Let's think about love. Hopefully, most of us in here have a sense of love. I hope. Now, has it been easy? Loving? No. Right? Most relationship is about negotiating, what do you mean by love? What do I mean by love? And then also in each context, right? Holding hands in public or not. When do we define ourselves as something? Right? As a couple or not? That's a big thing, right? Right? Do we celebrate the first date we had? Is it, you know, or versus our when we decided we're partners or whatever? So these things come as we negotiate them together and have some agreement. Of course, then there are some can be some general sense of agreement, and that varies a lot. For instance, our community sense of loving is very different from. It took many years for the more dominant culture to include our sense of what loving is, wouldn't you say? Right? And even here, there are other ways that we can define ourselves. Even the, you know, we had a discussion, Bernie and I, like, I use the word queer because I'm old, and I came from, you know, queer nation activism. So queer was, we were taking back the word. And to me, that's a very powerful, empowering word. And yet, I know that for some people, that's not a word that they appreciate. And like just I shared in the beginning, too, just defining ourselves on one level has been great that, you know, our community has really expanded to include, even I think a few years ago when I taught here, I don't think we had A. And someone's like, you must be sure to have A in the LGBTQI, I think we had. And then 2S was added, right? So we keep on expanding that. And also, how do we define ourselves in that? It's really, on one level, an individualistic thing, and on another level, as a community, we need to do that. And when we're not clear what that is, it can be really difficult to feel like we belong, right? Or feel like there's not necessarily a general agreement. And so our practice in some ways is to open up to different ways of expressing it. My partner has a very good chosen family of animal rights activists, and so she has a niece from there, and who's just turned 20. And you know, we want to be very open, and Deb's like an auntie that she can come and talk to. So one time she was trying to talk to her about, you know, what is her sexuality, you know, so to be open. I mean, not that we haven't been open. Her mother is a lesbian and all that, but she was just, you know. And so she said, well, you know, it's something, I don't remember all the details, but basically, like, use the word queer, you know. And the young person said, we don't call ourselves queer. We don't call ourselves bisexual. We are pansexual. That's what we are. And so now we're like, oh, okay. Pansexual is the word when you're talking to 20-year-olds and under, right? So, how does this relate to my Dharma talk? It's in here. I'm going to get to it. So part of joy, we think joy is so easy, right? Who here when I said, oh, joy, you wouldn't go, oh, I want some. And yet joy is difficult because one, for some of us, we weren't given a lot of joy or we weren't shown joy in a way that worked for us. Sometimes people use us for their joy. Right? And so joy is a really difficult thing. And when you haven't been given that, being with not knowing, right? And having to self-define on one level can seem freeing, but on another it can be really scary. Especially, ironically, when you're in an environment in which people seem really joyful about their identity, right? And yet when you're questioning or you're not quite sure, like I told you guys at the beginning, I said, should I come out again? And part of me was afraid. And honestly, doing it since then, it has been at the back of my mind, you know, like, oh, should I or shouldn't I, you know? One day I'm like, oh, in the closing circle, I'm going to put they, you know, and just really step into my gender. Like, I don't have a problem that I'm gender non-binary, right? Or excuse me, gender non-conforming. But I don't, the way that I came to it was very much that it's an empowering thing and it's so important to be known by the dominant culture too, because for my generation, it was a activism kind of thing and a very much having to claim for ourselves. And so in the defense of it, it gets really like tight. You see, when you got to claim who you are, then there's a point in which it can become a solidifying, tensing kind of thing. And so on a weird way, when it's open, then I'm still stuck with the, okay, I need to define it in a way that isn't offensive and fits in. Does that make sense or not, right? Whereas, like, I think, you know, I do know this person who's 20-year-old. They're like, oh, that's who I am, right? And one of them's so happy that they get to be so, like, nonchalant about it. And part of me is envious. That was so easy. Don't you know all the work I had to do just to say lesbian, for goodness sake, right? And so this is the in all the Brahmaviharas, there are what's called the far enemy and the near enemy. And the far enemy of joy is envy. And it's a far enemy just in the sense that that's the one that often comes up around it. Not the far enemy as in it's not the one that shouldn't happen, because we're humans. And around joy, there's going to be envy. Because how come those people get... I was teaching a POC group recently and talking about Buddha nature, which is very much a Mahayanist. I think Thanissara Bhikkhu said it only appeared once in the Pali Canon, whereas it's everywhere in the Mahayanist sutras, right? And so, which is fundamentally where the capacity of opening, and we should be confident in that. And so then this person said, but sometimes I envy white people, right? That they have privilege and entitlement. What do I do with that? What do I do with that? And the one that came up for me as an answer was, one, it's the Brahmaviharas, which is that joy is here and we practice to expand it, right? And it is part of the practice, and part of the purifying of it is that the difficulty around it comes up. And this is the other thing. This is a practice, right? We come to these kind of practices and we hear, right? Especially if this is your first retreat, you probably did not come for the knee pain you're having or the back pain or the, you know, someone's walks too loud. I'll say my big thing in those rooms. Shutting those doors so tight, I'm like, don't they know mindfulness, right? Or the, how come, where did people end up click, click the toothbrush on the sink after they brush their teeth? My neighbors. It seems like I always have a neighbor. Click, click, right? So there's a lot of, if nobody told you that would be part of your suffering here, did they? You came here wanting ease and joy. Now, the hard thing is, it isn't that we have to suffer to get joy and ease. It is that they're not separate from each other. Joy and envy coexist. And so our practice is really to be with them both. Now, I got a little off, so let me try to go back to where I have a flow here that I want to get back to. So, the third noble truth is a cause for joy, right? I will also say that a way that I've been framing the four noble truths is called the engaged four noble truths, which is to bring in much more structural understanding. And so the first is that, and it's to be a restorative model, and actually started at a Gen X teacher conference when there was a lot of sexual misconduct in the Buddhist community. And a social work model was brought in as a restoration practice for us. And I love it. I'm a social worker, right? And then, but me, being me, thinking, well, there must be something in Buddhism that could also work, and because we keep on, you know, anti-racist training, proper, or, you know, what was the wording in the past? Different kind of communication workshop. Always seems to bring in these models. And so I, and Bernie's been supporting me this from the beginning. She's been my cheerleader, I know. Thank you, sister. So we start out as a restoration. We actually say that harm and harming is present. That's the first noble truth. The second then, that if we understand fully the causes and condition for harm and harming, and then in that, we know that we can unlearn it or relearn a different way. And so the third is that we actually, individual and collective agency for ending harm is possible. And then the fourth is that the Eightfold Path actually empowers us to have agency, both individually and collectively. Now, in that sense, to me, then that mudita is a kind of undoing, right? We have agency to undo the impact of harm that has happened to us. So I want to bring in some ways about how to undo mudita as undoing. And the first is that to undo that we are just oppressed, just hurt, and just harm. I was going to bring in, I brought the wrong one. But I have carried this printing, the Xerox. This is in 2002. At Tassajara, I read a book called Buddhist Women on the Edge, which is a whole collection of writings by Buddhists, female Buddhists, in the United States. And Bell Hooks was in there. And I remember her piece is called Contemplation and Transformation. And she had a line in there that just blew my mind. She said, "It was a big moment when I realized that I am more than my pain." Because I came to practice to get rid of my pain, right? Probably most of you came here to get rid of your pain in some way. Who here did not come to get rid of your pain, right? Okay. And so by that I mean that one, it expanded my sense of, oh, it's not just all about pain. What else in me, right? So that's a way of bringing in joy. That I'm not just pain, there's joy here. So in a way, what we want to do is we want to recenter our perspective of hurt and harm, of suffering. And in a way, we recenter the dominant view of what is. So on one level, like from being, you know, I in my late teens and 20s and 30s, I worked in the anti-violence against women and children, right? Domestic violence for the most part. And so, you know, there was a shift from victim to survivor as a way of shifting. This is like, I'm more than my pain kind of shifting. And now I actually want to say that we really, as oppressed people, have to shift from just survivors to thrivers. We have to really think of ourselves as healthy, because the hurt, the impact of oppression is harming us not just in the acts of isms, but in the resulting, the impact, right? The high blood pressure in many communities, especially Black communities and Latinx community, the high rate of suicide in the trans community, right? So we want to really be able to find a way in which we center the joy of our life. And of course, that's partly like gay pride. That's a way of centering joy, right? So to me, we do that by undoing. And another way of saying undoing is to let go, right? Or letting go. And first, I would say, is to let go of the hold it has on us, right? There's a story in the teachings about how anger, right, is like a acid in a bowl, and it wears away at the bowl. So to hold anger in yourself is to have the acid eating away at you. Hatred is the same way. So one way is actually to learn to be with the impact of the hurt and harm, or the harm, which is hurt. And a lot of it is what we're doing here. And for many of us, we think of that as, you know, I come here and I'm just going to peel away all the layers of hurt. You've heard I think many people have talked about the onion analogy, right? It just keeps on, you need to keep on peeling it. But what do you do with an onion? You cry. You cry with an onion. So not long ago, I came up with another analogy that I think I threw out at my Sangha, but today I'm developing it just a little bit more. And to me, it's the artichoke analogy. Now, an artichoke, you got to peel away, right? To get to the heart, that's where the good part is. But you don't just peel it away and throw everything away. There's a little bit on that piece. And you know, an artichoke has that pointy point. So on a certain level, you have to be careful. But when you peel away, there's a little bit that's really tasty, especially with butter, vegan or not kind of butter, right? So there's something there that still nourishes you, that feeds you. And even when you get to near the heart, there's that prickly, I was going to say S-H-I-T, I'm trying not to swear. There's that prickly stuff that you have to peel off, right? Before you get to the heart. So you have to clean out the roughage. A little bit maybe like cleaning out the wound kind of thing. To get to the tender heart. And so the tender heart is also to be celebrated, right? Most of you, when you thought joy, you probably didn't think, oh, that means I have to be vulnerable. And yet, how many times when you have been vulnerable, there's joy? Intimacy takes a lot of vulnerability, right? So the tender heart, and that's what's here. That's what's happening here. I know, you know, if you came to me in a PD and you were crying, and I said, oh, yay, you would probably hit me. But inside, I'm going, ah, there's some shift, you know, and in part because many of us have been taught not to cry, not to show vulnerability. And a lot of it is gender-based, and a lot of it is also certain kinds of cultural-based, or, you know, gender-conforming kind of base, right? So much of oppression is about how we should be, and in our community in particular, how we should be tough in the male and female binary, And you know, I'm not saying anything you don't know, but I of course, always thought that the ones who diverged from the sense of what is feminine norm and masculine norm were the ones who got the most oppression, right? And yet our tender heart is our human wholeness. Right? And it's the heart that connects us. It's our humanity. So that's one way, peeling away at the things that kept you protecting your tender heart. When I lived at Tassajara, the monastery, we worked really hard in the summer, 5 months in heat. And if you think this is hot, it's really hot there. And, you know, we run like a resort in the summer, the students. So we would get visitors who did body work. And this man from Mount Madonna who did acupuncture, you know. And I went to see him. You know, we were just talking. And I said that I have cracked this collarbone 4 times and broken it once. And that was up to the age of 10. Right? And he said, oh, I have this theory that your collarbones or your clavicles are actually, because they hold the rib cage, they're actually there to help protect your heart. And it sounded like you had a lot of heartbreak in your early life. I was adopted at 8. I was in the war. My mother died at 8. I was adopted by white people who, they're all dead now. Beautiful people, and it was not easy. I did not kill them, and that didn't come out right. Strike that out, who's ever making this recording. But it was a hard time. I had a hard time. Right? And it's that sense that, and also, by the way, the posture, in Zen we say that we take the posture of awakening, right? That this posture itself is Buddha. That's what we say in Zen. The posture itself is Buddha, not like Buddha. We don't say sit like a Buddha. We say when you sit in Zazen, you are Buddha. And the posture, because I teach a lot, and I said some in my yesterday in the instruction, if you lift the whole ribcage and settle it, this is a posture of awakening. This is a posture that is open to receive. And yet most of us, when we're hurt, we go like this. I hunched for many years. And probably most of us, you know? So it's a sense of protecting the heart, when really our practice is to open the heart and to learn to have the stability that, yes, this is the posture of awakening, to be open to receiving. I tell my students who take the precepts or study with me, I should say, is that, you know, in some ways we practice to live with a heart on our heart sleeve, you know, that expression, to be confident in that and to be okay with that. It's not easy, but that's the one. So the one way is to figure out where does all the armor that we have to take off so that we can live open-hearted. Now, another way is to let in what we thought was to be let go. I'll say that again. To let in what we thought was to be let go. Recently, someone came to talk with me, and they were saying how they notice that they have an armor, right? A hardness that is protecting their vulnerability and their softness. And that bringing metta to it was helpful to notice that. And then someone I know and have worked with a lot, I said, well, what is your attitude towards your armor, though? Right? What is your attitude towards your armor? Most of us think, oh, So first we think, oh, this is an armor and it has protected me. And now I don't need it anymore. So I'm really practicing here to get rid of my armor and to throw it away. I want to propose to you that actually perhaps, you know, it could be to build, not a shrine per se, but perhaps somewhere in your house, you just leave all these armors that you've taken off to remind yourself, you know? I don't know whether this analogy works or not, but I was thinking, maybe it's a little, too bad we can't take, like, maybe somebody knows how, but pictures of our, I don't know, it's not aura, and I'm a Buddhist, so of course not an aura, but some sense of what those armors are, right? And on one level, I think it's a little bit like, you know how your parents, when you go home, somehow it always seems to be walking up the stairs or right inside the foyer where everyone who comes can see it, but they have pictures of you from all the years, right? And some haircuts, you're like, right? Oh, I wish, Mom, why do you have to put that picture up? Right? I have one that they talked me into getting a perm when I was 13, and I have the straightest hair on earth, so it's just like kinky kind of thing. I mean, kinky hair is not a problem, but on me, it was a problem. Right? Right? So it's just like a bad haircut, basically. Or else there's that picture of me that I was like sneering. I thought I was smiling, but when I came back, I was sneering, right? You can guess how old I was, 13, right? Life is so hard. It's a picture, like that armor, a picture of the armor of when you were suffering and you couldn't hide it, right? You couldn't hide it, however much you thought you were hiding it. It showed. And so maybe you don't have to put it up so that others can see it or is so, but maybe just keep it in a place that you, that's loving and caring as a progression of not things you got rid of, but things that are part of you that got you to where you are now. So to me, this is a sense of non-duality, right? There isn't just joy or envy. There isn't just harm or not harm. Where is it that it is actually something that's all-inclusive, that is here? So my students, we study the precepts for 8 months. And recently, we've been on precept. So in the Zen tradition, we have 16 bodhisattva precepts. The first three are to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Then there's a set of three called the pure precepts, which is classically to do good, one, not to do evil, the second. And then the old tradition is to, in the Theravadin tradition, is to, let's see, how does it go? I think it is to let go of samsara, maybe? But in the Zen tradition, it's to live for the benefit of all beings. And then we have what's called the 10 grave precepts. And the first five are the ones like we took in the beginning of this. And then we have five other ones, and three of them involves speech. So that's how important it is. And seven is to not extol oneself and slander others. Also, a lot of time it's just heard of as not slandering. Now, I like this book, Sherry Huber, and because it's a very contemporary, I think, more contemporary. And she has this really cool way of putting things where this, I just read to you the kind of the classic, and then she has here, there are no winners or losers. Because this is a precept about competition. You have to slander somebody that you feel better than them. And the irony is, most of us do that when we feel not confident, I'll speak for myself. When I'm not confident, I know that I can tend to, try to seem better than somebody, right? If I was confident, I don't feel like that need, right? So what if your mindset was that there are no winners and losers? I don't have to be better than you or worse than you. I don't have to be better at this or worse than this, even in myself, right? How many of you, and probably no one here has thought, oh, shoot, I could be a better meditator if I've only, sat longer before I came here, or more, right? So, not competing or not coveting, doesn't that sound like envy, right? That's the prohibition, but the aspiration, here's the aspiration, to give my best effort and accept the result. Isn't that a kind of joy? If you could just know that you've done your best effort and accept the results. Recently, I doubt is a huge thing. And it's anything that you do for a long time, doubt comes up. So in this 8-month program, a lot of time people are, doubtful whether they should continue the program or not. And a lot of it has to do with, I'm sorry, Reverend Lynn, because I meet with them once a month. I didn't meditate very much this month, or I didn't do X, Y, and Z this month. And so, for me, I say, well, what about working with that you have done well enough? Well enough. And I'll tell you that it came in part on a retreat here in the last sit of the night, which, as we've told you, there's a little bit of dharmet to send you off. And Andrea Fella, and I think she said she got it from someone else, but she said, it's the end of the day. I'm paraphrasing. It's the end of the day. Can you say that, it has been a well enough day? That you've lived a well enough day. You've done well enough today. For some reason, for that retreat, I heard it. I mean, it's not like I didn't hear those words, but how I took it in, how I received it, was that, I have done well enough in my life. Because I'm an over-efforter. I'm like, this is partly why I sit in a chair now. This is the first time I've been here where I'm in a chair. In fact, the last time I was here in person, even on the last day of the retreat and the last sit, I was sitting for over an hour. And Gil looked at me and said, don't tell me you're still sitting long sits. That's the kind of over-efforter. So now I have tattered meniscus surgery is in my future. So for someone like me, well enough is a joy to be able to let myself say, oh, I have done well enough. And to even say, I have done well enough in my life. I've done the best I can with my life up to this moment. That's huge, right? So the result of accepting that you have given your best effort, or that you've done your best effort and accept the result, can lead to joy. Or another way to put that is to include everything. Yes, what if you're well enough the way you are? What if this pain that you're having, this feeling that you're having, this hurt, this whatever it is that you're having today. And today is the day, actually. Some of you might have thought, oh, I believe I said in the opening circle, follow the schedule exactly on the first day. And how many of you thought, oh, I am never going to talk to her because she's like, right? Well, this would be the day that, and we do need to make effort, and that balance of effort is so key, without a doubt. And yet this is the day that you should, that it's useful to look for ease. Right? In the first day, day and a half, to build concentration, we want to really keep on applying effort so that the concentration stabilizes. And once it stabilizes, we can push ourselves too hard and actually lose the concentration. So now it's time to relax into it. Another way to put that is you trust the practice, or you trust that your efforts have been well enough. And one way is to say that everything that is happening is okay as it is. Doesn't mean it's comfortable. Doesn't mean it's not full in a way that you don't want it to be full, or not enough. Right? Whatever it is that is the judging of it, it's time to turn down the doubt and to look for joy. Or another word for it is ease. Look for ease. Where is the ease now? You know, when I practice in Vietnam, just because we're talking about fruit, I guess. An artichoke is a fruit, I believe. No, maybe it's a vegetable. Anyways. At Chuk Lum Bamboo Forest Nunnery that I practice at, they use everything. I was there for the Lunar New Year, which is Tet. And so they take, if you've ever had it, it's like a sticky rice with beans, mung beans in it, and peanuts sometimes, or bananas in it for the sweet version. And then they steam it for 10 hours in coconut broth of sort. But they make the coconut fresh. But then, you know, the hull and the husk and everything, they just chop that off, and then it goes into the garden. Talk about like zero waste, right? They use everything. Or else the other thing is, you know, this is, I'm vegan, right? And now, who knows about jackfruit as a vegan thing, right? This is 2006, I was in Vietnam. And when we go to eat, you go in and four nuns share, not a supersized community. There's a bowl of soup, then a bowl of rice, then a bowl of like this big for four nuns. The rice bowl is about this big, and the soup bowl is about this big. And then there was this, and before that, you know, it's true that I was vegetarian in monastic settings, but I was a meat eater. A meat eater. Certain time of the month, I was just like, give me a steak as rare as you can, right? Right? So, this thing came in a bowl, right? Like four pieces or something, usually. And I, you know, picked it up and put it in my bowl and started to eat it, and I thought, this seems like beef. Like, you know, like chimichurri kind of beef. Right? Kind of the strands. And so afterward, I was like, what is this stuff? Right? And it was a stew, and it was So tasty. Now it's kind of like the stuff you get in a can that's like, for the most part, barbecue something another. But at the time, I had no idea. And it's actually the part of the jackfruit that's thrown away. Jackfruit is a fruit that's yellow and really sweet, has a big seed in it that sometimes steam to use also. But then it's the, besides the outer, it's a lot of it. It's this husk part that's thrown away. But it's now, it's used as a way to, like, they don't throw anything away. They find a way to use it. So what if, you know, our practice isn't, it's not an undoing to throw away. It's an undoing of where is it that it harms us? Where is it that we've still think, still believe, still act, still relate to in a way that's harming versus that it can feed us, that is here as something that we can learn from. It's from a book called Mind Sky, Zen Teachings on Living and Dying, a new book from Jakusho Kwan, who actually was the first student, first, Suzuki Roshi was brought to the United States at the request of the Japanese American community in San Francisco, in part still healing from being in concentration camps, of course, doing World War II. And he came to attend to that community. And then there were, and this is, I'm not twisting the story, there are books on this. All these hippies, you know, who had got tired of all the side effects of drugs, heard, oh, there's a Zen master that, you know, can alter my mind. So let's go practice with him. And one version is that, you know, hippies were anti-authoritarian and also not into bathing. And that, and Japanese Americans are very, very into cleanliness. And so there was some friction. And so he chose to go with the, he called them the Americans for sure. And that's how San Francisco Zen Center started. But however, the first non-Japanese of that community, American of that community that came to sit with him is Jakusho Kwan, right? Who is a Chinese American. So this is from his latest book and a recent gift to me. Thank you. In our wisteria, the plant, right? That's the emblem of their temple. There's a deeper significance. Wisteria is the symbol on our temple crest, drawn from the crest of Rinzo Inn, Suzuki Roshi's 500-year-old temple in Japan. The meaning of the crest is found in Dogen's essay, Kato, the title of which is translated as Tangled Intertwined Vines, like kudzu or wisteria. Kudzu is a Japanese vine. Wisteria flowers are beautiful as they cascade down a wall, but the wisteria vines, like kudzu, are impenetrably tangled. There's a meaning behind the physical aspect of objects, just as we ourselves are more than object or subject. I'll say that one again. There's a meaning behind the physical aspect of objects, just as we ourselves are more than object or subjects. We experience this for ourselves in practice. The actual word kato means kotsu. That Japanese vine. It has a negative connotation because kotsu is a highly invasive perennial plant with climbing and tangled vines, a noxious weed for farmers. And in general, we just don't like to see things all tangled up, entangled upon entanglement. This entanglement represents delusion. This entanglement represents delusion. So the essay kato, meaning a tangled vine of kutsu, in our case wisteria, is talking about spiritual entanglement, intertwined delusional thoughts. However, Dogen encourages us to use kato to cut off kato. Generally, we try to get rid of things that we don't want or cut them out. But doing this just because we don't like something is not a good way to deal with it. To meet what we dislike head on, to meet dislike with dislike and use it, is like fighting fire with fire. To cut off means to sever, but in Zen, when we cut, we don't cut in two. We cut in one. Do you understand? When we cut, it's still one. Dogen says, generally, sages study in order to cut off the root of their spiritual entanglement, but do not use their entanglement to cut off entanglement. Do they not know how to use entanglement to cut off entanglements? It is rare to find anyone who knows that entanglements cannot be separate from transmission of the Dharma. That's another way to say what a Dharma talk is, the transmission of Dharma. I'll continue here. Or, to put it another way, we use delusion to cut off delusion. Delusion cannot be separate from enlightenment. Great enlightenment has no beginning and no end. On the other hand, delusion has no beginning and no end either. We cannot separate delusion from enlightenment. They are intertwined. This is the essence of the fundamental interrelationship of all things, which is emptiness. We can only enlighten delusion. Enlightenment and delusion are both always there simultaneously. They coexist. When I was a young student, I always wanted to get away from delusions. I didn't want to identify myself as a deluded person. But sure enough, that thought itself is a huge delusion. You can play at Zen for a long time until at some point you realize that you're not playing. Zen is your whole life. From this point on, you can practice wholeheartedly. When we say Zen like that, we don't mean, you know, practicing the Zen way. Zen in that way means being with life completely. So our practice is to let go eventually of everything, to undo any ideas we think. Not that we can't have an idea, but when we cling on to them, then it's time to let them go. Or more correctly, all of our conceptualization that tells us how things should be. Letting go is this, in this way, is undoing. Life is inconceivable. Every moment here is inconceivable. Every moment here is life. We are in life. There is no other life to get to after this retreat. On a certain level, no, I won't say that. There's no other life. So this, wherever you are, that you're in life. And we do want to know what life is, mind you. So we set up framing to know it. Right? And particularly, we want to set up skillful means. And this kind of practice is a kind of skillful means, the things that we're teaching you. You know, skillful means is a way to know yourself, right, and your experience. And the thing about Buddhism is that the Dharma, in Zen we say the Dharma, you know, is kind of like the finger pointing at the moon. The moon in Zen means enlightenment. And all anything does is to point you towards enlightenment. But you have to look at the moon yourself, right? I just direct you that way. So anything, any teaching is to be experienced for yourself. And I said that the Buddha's last words were to be a lamp unto yourself. How do you shine your awareness unto your own experience? You know, what is suffering? What is hurt and harm? How do I understand fully this hurt and harm? How do I know that I have agency so that this hurt and harm isn't just hurt and harm, and it's also joy, or what else is here besides hurt and harm? And then how is it that I can be empowered to do that by my practice, be it the Eightfold Path or another way? And yet we tend to cling to ideas. So once it becomes dogma, right? And this is some way the difficulty when you're not a new student. You have an experience, and so you want the next, you think the next one should be like the last one, or you think you know what you're doing, and that's how you can get caught, actually. Right? And so the second way is when you see that you're clinging, then you practice letting go. You undo. And the problem is, then we cling again. And that's okay, right? Once we realize, we let go. Right? To travel, you have to hold and go, and swing. You know, like when I practice in Thailand, monkeys, you know, they grab onto a vine, and then when they swing, at some point they let go to grab onto the other one. And on one level, that's a beautiful image, and you say, oh, the swing is life, and letting go. But no, that's not the only part of life. If they don't grab onto something else, they're going to fall. So life is the grabbing and the letting go, the grabbing and the letting go. The key is to know, when is the grabbing helping you to get somewhere or to keep you safe from, you know, part of the reason they're in the trees is their predators are on the ground. But sometimes they do drop to the ground to go get something. So our practice isn't separate. Our grasping is part of our practice. Our letting go is part of practice. When we remember that the whole thing is part of practice, then our chance of getting somewhere increases. So mudita is the joy that you have agency to be here in the midst of your life. Mudita is undoing of letting go of anything that keeps you away from the freedom of being fully present right here and right now. Thank you. Just sit for a minute.